This is Brian Cambria with news for the KVNF listening area, Monday, April 22nd, 2013. The Denver Post reports that the five men killed Saturday in Colorado's deadliest avalanche in 50 years were participants in a backcountry snowboarder event called the Rocky Mountain High Backcountry Bash. The massive avalanche below Loveland Pass Saturday afternoon left one survivor. Four of the five victims were expert snowboarders and one was an expert skier. They were representatives and founders of snow sport companies, guides, avalanche experts, and veteran backcountry travelers gathering in the normally safer spring season to celebrate backcountry snowboarding, raise money for the Colorado Avalanche Information Center, and test the newest gear. Unfortunately, their skill, preparedness, and safety awareness were no help when a 10-foot-thick slab of snow broke free and buried them in the avalanche in Sheep Creek Bowl. On Wednesday, May 1st, from 10 a.m. to noon, Delta County Commissioners will again hear testimony about the Hostetler henlaying operation on Palo Mesa, continuing a legal battle that has been ongoing over the past year. The hearing will take place in room 234 of the Delta County Courthouse. Neighbors of the facility have claimed that it is a health menace because of dust, contaminants, and noise. They say the laying operation's presence in a largely residential and small farm neighborhood is an industrial intrusion that the county should have disallowed based on its own regulations and master plan. The county says the business is consistent with other rural enterprises and poses no health risk. The case is complicated by the fact that the Hostetler family wants to put another such operation on Redlands Mesa. The current lawsuit against the county and the Hostetlers seeks to shut down the current henlaying facility and prevent the proposed facility from being built. The May 1st hearing will allow the plaintiffs to respond to air quality monitoring tests conducted by the county, as well as to a memo from Health Department Director Ken Nordstrom. This is the second time the court has remanded a decision back to the county. A Denver Post analysis has found that marijuana interests led by medical marijuana business groups and dispensaries have paid about $140,000 to lobbyists in the fiscal year that began in June. The real battle has not yet begun. Bills in the General Assembly to establish rules for recreational pot have yet to be introduced, and fewer than 3 weeks remain in the session. One especially controversial issue is whether to let recreational pot stores and commercial growers operate independently. An unlikely alliance of medical marijuana business groups, law enforcement, and a citizens group seeking to restrict the recreational industry want to use the medical marijuana model, which requires growers and sellers to be part of the same company and for stores to grow most of what they sell. Those advocating for a more open system include a labor union, activists, and smaller medical marijuana business interests. Representative Dan Pabon, a Denver Democrat and chair of the joint committee working to create legislation, said voters made clear they wanted marijuana to be regulated like alcohol, which has a three-tiered system of manufacturers, distributors, and retailers. Quoting Pabon, "The purpose of that is to prevent monopolies and cartels and a small amount of interests owning the industry," end quote. The committee voted 7-3 to allow recreational pot stores and growers to operate independently. The Aspen Times reports that the U.S. Forest Service will list prime property in Aspen's West End for sale. The agency will use the proceeds to redevelop its adjacent Aspen Ranger District facilities. The cost of rebuilding the complex has been estimated at $9 to $10 million. The one-acre property to be sold has been divided into five lots. Each could be sold separately, or all five could be purchased by one buyer. The property has been appraised by the Forest Service, but its value is a closely guarded secret. After the auction, the agency will compare the bids to the appraisal and decide whether to go forward with the sale. A spokesman said he does not know how much the Forest Service originally paid for its aspen holdings, but the agency did uncover a letter written in the 1960s by the then district ranger to the White River National Forest supervisor, recommending against the purchase of an adjacent West End block that was available. It was the ranger's opinion that paying $5,000 for a second city block in Aspen was a waste of money. The Montrose Daily Press reports that the Archaeological Conservancy, with assistance from History Colorado and the Colorado State Historical Fund, has purchased the Shavano Valley Rock Art Site from the Montrose Community Foundation. The Archaeological Conservancy is a nonprofit organization that acquires archaeological and historical properties for the purpose of preservation, research, and education. The weathered sandstone bluffs west of Montrose reveal a history recorded not in words, but in symbols carved into rock. The Shavano site has been dated from the Archaic through Historic Ute periods, or 1000 BC to AD 1900. Representatives from the Albuquerque-based Archaeological Conservancy were in Montrose for a tour of the site and a meeting with local officials last week. Last week on IC Change at thealmanac.org, there were lots of photos of snow and the dust that blew in from the south and west. The April moisture and the low temperatures were a welcome contrast to last year's hot, dry weather. Spring is always a tricky, changeable season here, as KVNF's Marty Derlin reports.
Paonia resident Amber Kleinman has been reading through the daily journals of William Beasley, an orchardist and farmer who lived up Stevens Gulch in the first half of the 20th century. Recording selected entries for thealmanac.org and comparing them to current weather and conditions, Kleinman, a small acreage farmer who keeps a journal herself, has gained a new perspective.
I started working on the 1930s, which we knew were like the Dust Bowl era, or some of it. And so when I was reading the journal and kind of comparing it to what we just experienced in 2012, it was just fascinating to know that it was not that unusual, that this has happened before. And it was actually probably worse in 1934 than it was in 2012.
So what you're talking about in 2012 was the incredible drying, particularly in March.
Right.
And the just the drying up of every bit of moisture that we had. And we didn't have that much.
Yeah. The lack of snow, getting rain when you expect to get snow. The same things happened in 1934. Also that it warmed up really early and apricots started to go into flower March 12th. We're in full flower by March 24th in 1934.
Did it change your idea about global climate change at all?
No. I really think that it's, you know, weather's more drastic today than it has been. But because we have records like this, we can look back and realize that things do fluctuate and it's not like it's never happened before.
How have you changed by reading his journals? Do you note things differently maybe or note different things?
Yeah, I do actually. I guess when I enter my journals, I get a little wordy and I realize that maybe it's more important to, you know, note the temperature, note the weather, what you do. And so when you look back or when other people look back at what you've written, it's useful. He has different names for different amounts of storms. For instance, like on the lower end of the scale, you have a dab of rain. A little bit more is a skift of rain, which I actually had to look up because my spell check didn't recognize it, but it's actually a real word, skift. It's a light rain.
S-K-I-F-T.
And then there's a splat of rain, which is more than that. And then there's a dandy rain, which is a really good rain as a dandy rain. And then there's the rain like hell, which was like, it's really raining. So I love that he uses these words over and over to note how much rain actually fell. It didn't just rain. There's all different kinds of rain. April 13th, 1934, he says, harrowed and marked alfalfa most of the day, warm like summer, rained a shower before noon, fixed stitches in the hayfield in the p.m., and it rained again, quite a little shower.
A new category, quite a little shower.
Quite a little shower, yeah. Where does that fit in between splat and skift? on April 18th, he harrowed and planted some potatoes, wormed trees, and planted a little corn. It's really early. Like, this is the year I was talking about that started warming up really early. He planted corn, which is, you have to wait until the ground's warm to really start doing that. And then on April 20th, 1934, he says, set water on alfalfa for the first. So he's already started irrigating. Delicious apples about in full bloom.
Reading the journal entries, most of them 3 to 5 lines, you get the feel for a different time.
All the notes about how much people helped him and how he helped other people. I mean, he constantly had people coming over to help him prune, to help him butcher, and then he would go to their house and help them butcher and them prune and haul hay and haul rock. And you can kind of just see life as it was back then, very simple, you know. This is, we wake up in the a.m., this is what we do. It's just this very simple life.
For I See Change at thealmanac.org and KVNF News, I'm Marty Derlin, hoping for another skift of rain.
Make I See Change a part of your routine and contribute to the record of our lives on the Western Slope. Visit thealmanac.org to be a part of I See Change and Two-Way Radio. As Red Green likes to say, we're all in this together. Keep your stick on the ice. Happy Earth Day. Thus concludes today's newscast. For KVNF News, I'm Brian Cambria. Good day.